Virginia! Give us our land! Give us our land!
Turkey must pay!
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 My name is Zarik Baghdadian. I go to Holy Angels Academy. And I graduated from Hovhannanyan Armenian School. Armenian was my first language. I know how to read, write, and speak Armenian. My parents were born in the Middle East, in Syria. And it was because of the Armenian genocide. People scattered in the Middle East. That's why there's a lot of Armenians in Syria, in Lebanon, in Beirut, in Halab, in Damascus, Latakia. And my parents both came here. And I'm an American citizen. I was born here. And I have a younger sister, a younger brother, and an older sister, both over here protesting. And I am here protesting against the Turks because two blocks down they are saying that they did not commit the Armenian genocide, but they did. And April 24th, Monday, is the anniversary. In 1915, they committed the Armenian genocide. They killed almost 2 million Armenians brutally, and they're denying it to this day. There are many countries accepting it. France has accepted it, so many countries have accepted it, but the American, the USA is not accepting it, and so aren't the Turks.
In April 2006, it is a surprising sight to see young people protesting about an event that occurred over three generations ago. Yet, there they were, hundreds of Armenians on one side of Times Square and Turks on the other. Many Turkish youth are not eager to take responsibility for a crime that occurred so long ago and object to the depiction of their nation as bloodthirsty killers.
Armenians claim that during the World War I, Ottomans slaughtered 1.5 million Armenians in their area. That happened actually, but another way they claim it happened. And according to the Census Bureau of Ottoman Empire, there were less than that many number of Armenians living at that time in the whole country. When Ottoman Empire were in war with Russia, Armenians took part with Russian army because of the Russians' promise for independence for them.
Ottoman, for its national security, had to relocate the Armenian people to other parts of Turkey at that time.
Aram Arkun from the Zorab Information Center was the keynote speaker at a commemoration held at the Albany Capitol. On April 24th, the 91st anniversary of the execution of 300 Armenian leaders and intellectuals by the Ottoman Turks and the beginning of what is known as the Armenian Genocide.
It's indeed an honor to be here in this magnificent hall here in the capital of New York. The 21st century began as the 20th century did with genocide. It was born in violence. Such episodes of genocide leave their impact and last far more than the span of the immediate events themselves. And today, many people ask, why after 91 years are we still talking about, are we still commemorating the Armenian genocide? But I would like to go back in history to talk to you a little bit about the roots of this event and why the effects of such events of genocide reverberate to this day, both on the international scene as well as, of course, in the lives of those who have descended from survivors of genocide. Now, Armenia has a very long history. The Armenians go back to the first millennium BC. The Armenians live in a place that historically was a crossroads of civilization between what today is Turkey and Iran and south of the Caucasus Mountains. And this historical Armenia is the size of a relatively large state, such as France or the United Kingdom today. It played an important role in developing art and architecture. Armenian architecture served, according to some, as a precedent to Gothic architecture. Armenians were advanced in the early development of metallurgy, irrigation. Armenian craftsmen produced objects that were traded as far abroad as Italy and Europe and the Far East, even in the ancient times. And the Armenians had a number of different kingdoms. The Armenians became the first Christian nation in 301 AD, as is traditionally held. And the Armenians basically sided with the West culturally from that time on. But as luck would have it, just the very location that Armenia lived in, which was so fertile in terms of cross-fertilization of culture, also was a very dangerous location. And Armenia fell prey to a number of different invasions, starting with the Arabs in the 7th century, but most injuriously from the 11th to the 16th century by various Turkic peoples who eventually established the Ottoman Empire. And the majority of historic Armenia ended up under Ottoman Turkish rule. There are also portions of under the Iranian Empire and also portions that by the 19th century fell under Russian rule, but the majority were under Ottoman rule. And it was in this area that by the mid-19th century, Armenians began to migrate out to the United States and to New York. And why were they leaving their homes? Why were they leaving their ancestral lands? It was because of persecutions, because of difficulties even at that early period, which by the end of the 19th century developed into large-scale massacres under Sultan Abdul Hamid. At least 200,000 to 300,000 Armenians were killed from 1894 to 97 during these massacres, and this spurred a great wave of emigration. And again, in 1909, there was a smaller massacre of some 20,000 Armenians under the Young Turks, who were constitutional reformists, but their reform plans did not really take root in the Ottoman Empire. And ultimately, the lack of punishment for those smaller scale massacres were one of the factors. This impunity of the criminals encouraged yet again an even larger crime, an attempt to completely wipe out the entire Armenian population living in the Ottoman Empire during World War I, a very convenient time because the Ottoman Empire entered the war on the side of the Germans and the Austrians against the British, French, and Russians and other allies. The Armenians were killed in a very brutal way, and the Armenian Genocide is the first major genocide in modern times that used modern forms of technology, whether it's modern forms of transportation like railroads that Germans were later to use to full effect during the Holocaust, or telegraph, which was at that time the modern way of communication. These are all due to modernization. And that's why, really, the Armenian Genocide is the first modern genocide. It's not just the first major genocide of the 20th century, but it's also, in a way, a model for understanding later genocides that happened in the 20th century and now are happening in the 21st century. The Armenian men were conscripted into the Ottoman army and soon taken out into labor battalions in which they were either shot or killed in even more brutal ways. Women, children, and elderly were deported from their towns and cities on long trips through very inhospitable territory. They suffered attacks by specially organized groups of criminals who had been released from Ottoman prisons for that very purpose. These groups of Cheta, these groups of bandits, raped, killed, plundered, and diminished the number of Armenians who were proceeding on these caravans to their destinations of the deserts of Syria and Iraq and Mesopotamia, where again concentration camps were formed. Those Armenians who weren't killed by attacks along the way and who didn't succumb to the terrible conditions of heat and lack of food and water that they were subjected to deliberately by the gendarmes and the Ottoman officials that were accompanying them were subjected again to repeated attacks at the end of 1915 and 1916 in these territories. And there are a lot of documentaries on the Armenian Genocide, but there's an amazing scene. It's in a place in the Syrian deserts where there's a narrow entrance to a cavern, and just about 5-10 years ago, an English reporter and a film crew went to that entrance, and they were told by local Arabs, by Bedouins, that there were a lot of bones of Armenians there. And they dug a little bit into the sides of the entrance of the cavern, and sure enough, human skull bones, human bones were pried loose from there. And it turned out that that was the place where over 10,000 Armenians found their final end. It was a primitive sort of gas chamber. The Armenians were pushed into that cavern, and at the narrow entrance, fires were lit so that the smoke would suffocate the Armenians. And eventually, so many Armenians were pushed into there that the gases that came from the dying bodies of the Armenians themselves were enough to suffocate, asphyxiate the later Armenians who were pushed into there. And there are still so many bones there. And this is just a physical manifestation of the horror that went on at that time that just can't be eradicated even after so many years. So after the end of World War I, luckily the Ottoman Empire was on the losing side in the war and was not able to fully exterminate, annihilate the entire Armenian population. Armenians returned temporarily. There were actually court-martial trials by the new Ottoman government that actually acknowledged what had happened, but these were short-lived. A nationalist movement that was led by Kemal Atatürk established a new Republic of Turkey and put an end to this attempt at justice. And ever since then, the Armenians have had to face denial. So this is why today, 91 years afterwards, we have to be gathered here not just to pray for the souls of the dead, but also to try to still work for some kind of justice for the memory of these people, and not just for those people, but for all those people who are still continuing to suffer genocide today, because such a genocide affects generations afterwards. Now, what's interesting is that 5-10 years ago, when I would speak on the Armenian genocide, I would start off by saying that this is the forgotten genocide because so few people recognize it. And this is something that we need to all get together and work to rectify, because even after Hitler, the 20th century is littered with genocides, and every time we see the same cycle. We don't seem to learn our lesson that genocide, if let unpunished without any sort of justice, leads to more and more deaths, leads to more and more injustice. We want to have a world that our children, our grandchildren are safe and fit to live in, then we have to struggle against this kind of poison.
Anoush Tertalyan is an Armenian-American who has been active in the Armenian freedom struggle for over 30 years. She participated in the interviews of 3 genocide survivors.
Arnorik Aminian was born in 1912 in Izmir, Turkey. You are about to hear an eyewitness account of her experience as a child, from seeing her father being taken away to hiding in an orphanage, and finally being rescued by the U.S. Navy. Like many survivors, she is worried that the Turks might still want to harm her.
I said, my father's not here. They look. Finally, they got my father. They beat him. They took him upstairs to my mother. She says, there's your husband. Now he's going to get a good. And my father says, they take him. He says, Sonny, don't worry. I'm going to be back and I'm going to buy the Vicks to you to eat. Yes, he says, he's going to come back, bring the Vick. And I start hitting my father. And I started to him, don't hit my dad. He hit me right there. And I start bleeding. So my mother says to me, go ahead next door, the Greek lady, she does something, honey. So I went the next Greek lady next door. He took salt and he put it on right my feet. You imagine, it's open place and that pain, I'm screaming. So finally, now they took my father, they're going and I'm screaming, daddy, daddy. So she said, don't cry, don't worry, I'll be back. But would never see my father. They took the van. Now they come, I don't know how many days. Those 2 men, they came back. He says to me, you want your father? I said, yeah. Mm-hmm. He says, there's your father now. They had my father's jacket, all blood, and the pants too. They give it to me. They killed it, they must be. They bought my father's jacket. And I start crying, my mother's sitting. My mother is fearing my baby brother. He says, how could you tell him that little girl? And they killed my father, and I didn't.
Aydın is a place near Izmir where there was soldiers' cousin.
So that's all it was. I never see my father after that. Now my grandmother, he says to me, where's your grandmother? He's sick, I say, he's in a hospital. He says, what hospital? He says, come on, you gavur. They call us gavur.
Unbeliever, yes.
He held my hand, so we went to church. Surp Stepanos, there's a church. We went there, my grandmother, she's 90 years old, my mother told me. She's in a hospital. So I took them to the hospital. So they go right in the hospital, they knock the door, they went in. My grandmother, she get up the bed, said, oh, Rick, what are you doing here, honey? Nene, I said, they bring me here, they want to see you. This is your grandmother? Your father's mother? I said, yeah. She says to her, you old witch. You took all those Armenian men and your son. You shipped them in Paris, eh? My grandmother says, I don't know nothing. You don't know nothing. Now you're going to know very good. He took his gun. He shot my grandmother right in the face. I'm in the bed. I remember everything. I'm not lying. The old ladies, they get up. What happened, Haygarush? What happened? They killed all those Armenian old lady in the hospital. I'm sorry. They all dead died from the Mayas. One by one. He killed the 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 3. He didn't ask what they are. He didn't feel sorry. He shoot every one of them, those old ladies. They all died because their sons in the army. So they killed them. And meantime, the priest come. He says, what's going on, Nur? So they took the priest. You want to know what's done? He says, where else you hiding? Tell me. Priest, he says, I don't hide in anybody. This poor old lady says, they're sick. And we brought them here. They have to take care of them. What right you have to kill him, these old ladies? He says, if you want to know, you're going to get it yourself too. Pop, they killed the priest from the Mayas. Now, one more thing. We had an Armenian orphanage. They came, not those Turk, those two, another Turk. You know, the school big. We had a bit heavy doors. We kids, we stay in front of the window, like the blinds, how we open and we look. We see and they're talking. They say, one says to the other one, Gavurs, let's get in. The other one says, look at, they're not Gavurs, they're not Armenian, they're American children, don't bother. No, she says. So they go across the street. It's not nice to say, but I'm going to tell her. They ask those Jewish people, those kids, tell us the truth. Otherwise, we're going to kill you. Who's those children? American or Armenian? The Gavurs. He says, you go ahead. They're all Armenian. No American. American soldiers, they came. They put a flag at our school. And they told us they're going to come. They're going to save us. Don't worry. So that's what they believe what the Jews, they say. They came right in. They took our food, throat on the floor, everything. They start beat us up. We was all crying. We was kids. We didn't have a school teacher, nothing. And they took all those young teachers and the young girls, 18 years old, 19 years old, they're the ones that take care of us. They took all those teachers, they left. Now American came back. Where's the teachers? I said to the Americans, the third they came, they took our teachers and our young girls, like the hair of their sister, the mother. They took the van. So now the American, they say, come on, kids, stay in a line. They took a rope, they tied us our hands, like me and my sister, everybody. This is the older girl. And we start walking. What do you want to see? Excuse me, you know the street here, we have three, every cyborg. We saw all those girls, the Turk, they had them no clothes, they had them their head chopped down, torturing them. Those Turk, they cut their heads, they had them tied, they cut their breasts. We all cried, start screaming in the street. American, they took pictures of those girls, how did they torture them? Mm-hmm. It was horrible thing. And the American Navy says, don't cry, we have to go now. Keep quiet, don't make a lot of noise. And we saw that too. I saw that too, my own eyes. Mm-hmm. They kill all those, our school teachers. They kill all the young girls and everybody. So now they took us on the ship. American soldiers, the Navy. And the Turk, they don't want to use the gun. One test the other one. They gabble, put stick the knife. Sick enough, torture to go. And he came hold my hands, the Turk. And I said, America, America, America. I'm hollering the Navy. He came, says, what are you doing with the kid? He says, I'm going to take this kid. Oh, no, he says, you get out of here right now. He says, I'm American, I'm not Turk. Get out. So he got scared, he left. Thank God my life, it was safe. That's the way I was, I'm alive for it. American, they took me. And they went, they put us in a ship, and they brought us to Greek Piraeus.
Israel Arabian was born in 1905 in Harpet. During the Armenian Genocide, the Turks captured many children and forced young girls to marry them. Israel's sister was one of these girls, and he followed her into servitude. When he found out they wanted to make him a eunuch, he escaped and was saved by the American Near Eastern Relief Society. Despite his great age, he volunteered to speak to us.
You were a genocide survivor. Tell me what you went through.
The Turks captured me and my sister. She was a virgin.
Did your sister want to marry the Turk, or was she forced to marry the Turk?
She didn't want to. He wanted to marry her to get our property. We had cows and everything. They sent me to a Turkish school.
What happened to your parents?
They killed them.
Many people in the rest of your family killed, your cousins, your aunties.
Some 50 people were killed.
How did they kill them?
They threw them in the river.
When you saw that, what did you do? How did it make you feel?
I was small and survived through that difficulty, luckily.
How long did he spend with the Turkish people?
4 years.
How did they treat him?
Because I was serving them, they treated me okay.
How did you know that the Turks wanted to make you a eunuch?
Yes, I knew because I was big. I was 8 years old. Then on an army holiday, I escaped. Eventually, I connected with the Near East Relief Organization, and I went to their orphanage.
How long were you in the orphanage?
3 years.
When is the last time he saw his sister?
Before I left for Greece, I went to see her.
Never sent a letter or tried to contact her?
Yes. I found out she had 6 children by him.
Is it possible you could find her now?
She's probably dead now.
If you could go back to your village and see it, would you want to go?
Everything is gone.
The Turkish government and a lot of Turks deny that this happened.
It's impossible. They took everything. The whole province of Kakbet was wiped out, and the Turks also wiped out all the other provinces.
Did you tell your children what happened?
Yes, they know everything.
Do you think there should be an armed struggle to gain some of occupied Western Armenia back?
Impossible.
Charlotte Kekagian was born in 1912 in Ninjde, Turkey. After her father was killed, She and her mother went on a forced march along with other Armenians into the scorching desert, where she remembers walking over dead bodies and witnessing the horrors of rape, torture, and murder. She was eager to speak of her ordeal.
Can you tell us what happened when the Turks came to your village?
Turk came to the door. You better get out right away. These were friendly Turks who liked us as neighbors. They said to my mother, you better get out if you want to live. And my mother, in a hurry, got me ready. And we got out. We didn't know where we were going. I was 8 years old. And maybe it was about April. You know, I was little. My father, they took away. So we got out and walk. We didn't know where we were going. In the wilderness. So we went quite a bit. Then we stopped someplace and they gave us little water. That's all. No food, nothing. And I'm so little, I have no shoes on my foot. The ground is so hot. I'm thirsty. I'm telling my mother, Mom, give me some. Tears in her eyes. Where is she going to get water from? We don't even know when we're going to stop, where we're going. So we kept walking and walking and walking. And other people, too. God knows, a lot of people. Mostly farmers. There were a few tradespeople. But the Turks didn't let them stay. They wanted to hold the whole town. So they made them close one by one.
Did you know the Turks? Were they from a neighboring town or were they soldiers? Who were the Turks?
I don't know where they came from. They were not familiar people. Like white. Yeah.
They were young?
Young.
When you were marching in the desert and you didn't have enough water and food, did some of the Armenians just die from hunger?
Yes, children. Mostly from thirst.
Did you see other groups of Armenians that was walking?
Yes. I saw a lot of Armenians, a lot of them, and a lot of kids. And they're crying. Mom, you know in Armenian, Dake, that means warm, it's hot, I can't walk. They want water. Chur means water.
How many days was it?
Oh, days and days, you know, I can't remember.
Were there dead bodies on the road?
Right on the floor. We almost step on them.
Did you see the Turks raping Armenian women?
We saw, but I didn't know what it was. I'm a child, you know, I thought maybe they were changing their clothes. Then when we saw them in nude, saying, how come? And we were outside, they're changing clothes.
Did you hear Armenian girls screaming?
Oh, and how.
And did you see any Armenian women fighting back when the Turks tried to rape them?
Yes.
How did they fight back?
With their hands.
And what happened when they fought back?
And pulled themselves away from them. They pushed them on the ground and laid on them. They were screaming. They didn't want it. They were the Turks doing it. They were enjoying it. It's a shame. I never saw people nude like that. I didn't know what to say. I was crying because I knew they were being hurt. I didn't realize it was a sexual thing. I'm a child. I don't know that.
And were the Turks grabbing young children?
Even the children.
They were raping the children too?
Yes.
Were they also raping the young boys?
Not as much boys. Girls, mostly.
How young were the girls?
Oh, the girls were 10, 8, around that age. Some of the most 14. They didn't know what was happening to them. They're crying and yelling. And the parents are not around. They're quite a distant. They are being guarded.
Did some of the Armenian children try to run away?
Yeah.
Did any of them escape?
How were they going to escape? They were all surrounded with guns and whatever implements they had.
Did you try to ask them where they were taking you?
We did. No reply. They say, quiet. No questions. You know, in Turkish.
Were these Turks soldiers or policemen, the ones that told you to leave?
They looked like policemen. They didn't look like soldiers. They dressed in common clothes.
We've heard that the Turkish officials released some prisoners from jail to attack the caravans. Mm. Do you think that these were ex-convicts, some of them?
I think so.
And so what happened if a child was crying? Did the Turks hit them?
They push you. You have to keep going. No sympathy at all.
Did you ever see a Turk kill a child?
Yes.
How did they kill them?
The one that couldn't walk at all. They got rid of it.
How would they do that?
Like a dagger or something they had. They stuck it and all fell on the floor and start shaking, and that was the end. I don't know what it was.
How many children did you see being killed?
Oh, at least 100. At least.
Were the Turks taking some of the children to sell?
Yes. They took my cousin to sell. They took her during the march, but we got her back. We came back to the village, and time went by. We knew that she was there. My mother had a bright idea. We went to court. We went to get her. They took me, so when she sees me, she'll run to me. They saw that she ran to us, and she started to cry. They knew that she belonged to us. The people that took her, the Turks, whoever it was, they wanted to adopt her for their daughter. They had her for almost a year, but they didn't hurt her. She was very pretty. But they told her, we'll kill you if you say you know them.
What do you think happened to your father?
They killed him. I don't even know him. I don't know how my mother got me. Whoever got us from the church group or someplace, they found us and they took us. They had like an orphanage. They kept us over there till they got in touch with my mother. Was the only one living soul.
And you went back to the village?
Yeah.
So how did you eventually have to leave the village again?
My mother worked in the orphanage, and they put me in the orphanage too with my mother, but my father was killed. She got little money from the orphanage, and we came to America at the age of my mother, 33, and I was 10. 1922.
So what has happened to your village now?
I don't know.
Do you know if it still exists?
I think it exists. It's called Nide, Konya.
Are you afraid of going back?
Oh, I would never go back. Never go back. Wow. Especially, I never saw my father. That hurts me more than anything. They were very jealous of Armenians because they were in all the businesses. And they were educated. They believed in education. So they figured without them, they'll have all the business. See? But I'm so surprised that after so many years of war, Armenians married Turks. Because they didn't go through what we did. But they heard the story.
Do you buy Turkish products? Do you ever buy anything that's made in Turkey?
I have no respect for them at all. That wasn't a nice thing to do. And they did it because Armenians were very aggressive and they didn't want that to happen.
What do you mean the Armenians were very aggressive?
They were in all the businesses. Jewelry business, printing business. They covered everything.
Right now, the American government does not recognize the Armenian genocide. How do you feel about that?
They should recognize it.
Why?
Why? Because what they did It was cruel. Just because they were aggressive, they had to kill them. Why didn't they try it business-wise and compete with them? How are they doing in America? Are they killing the Americans?
How do you feel when you hear that the Turks say that the genocide never happened?
Oh, I think that's terrible. How could they do that? How could they do that? I don't know how they could prove that.
Do you think that Turkey will ever admit that they did the genocide?
They did it. And the whole thing was jealousy. Because Armenians were so aggressive, and they helped one another. Mm-hmm. And they were in all the businesses.
What do you think are some effects of the genocide on the survivors?
I really don't know.
Armenians don't talk to each other about the...
We do, but the new generation doesn't know. Like my children, they don't know. They say, Mom, how could they do that? They're raised in America. They're born in America.
They don't understand.
No. They say, I don't know how you came to this age with all that trouble. And they say, Mom, and you're so kind. How could they do that? You know? I raised 3 children.
Do your children speak Armenian?
Not too much. My daughter speaks more than my boys.
Do you feel that the genocide was not only physical, but it was also a cultural genocide?
It affected them too, because I was affected. I always used to mention, I didn't have the privilege that you have in America, but at least I went to high school, no college. If it wasn't for my mother, I wouldn't be alive. When they heard my story, they said, Grandma, are you sure you're all right? They're so innocent. You know, they wonder how come I had all those problems and I could do what I do.
So then they have become American and that Armenian culture is lost, right?
Not really, but they know they're Armenians and they respect.
Have you ever talked to Turkish people in America and asked them about the genocide?
After the war, we came in contact, and they claimed they had nothing to do with it. I said, well, you heard about it, you read about it. What do you think of it? You think it was the right thing to do? Hearing the troubles we had, they don't want to do anything. But I know what we went through. It didn't matter. They didn't want any Armenian to exist. That was their motto. I don't know why this thing started. It's too bad. You know, we didn't win much. We lost a lot of lives. I remember my grandfather to see all these things happening. Tears in his eyes. He used to say, am I going to see these things my poor kids, great-grandchildren have to suffer? I can't forget that.
He was afraid it was going to happen again?
Yeah. It may happen again.
You think so?
I have.
Since they fled their land and spread to many countries, the Armenians have tried to find justice. We ask Aram Arkun, who is an Armenian genocide scholar, to speak about their fight for survival as a people.
When the genocide took place, obviously it was something that was very widely known. It was widely reported in newspapers throughout the world. And Armenians themselves commemorated the genocide starting in 1919. They didn't call it genocide then because the word only was coined during World War II, but they commemorated in successive years up until the present. However, the first generation of survivors, those who usually had to flee the Ottoman Empire or the Republic of Turkey and ended up in all kinds of countries in the Middle East and the West, didn't really have the means to pursue the issue of recognition of the Armenian Genocide or to combat denial of this genocide. They were too busy just trying to survive, to make their living and to rebuild their broken families and lives. And so it really took until the 1960s for Armenians to really get back onto their feet. And meanwhile, the Turkish government initially completely avoided dealing with the issue or periodically intervened in certain cases where there would be attempts to bring this issue to a broader public. For example, there's the famous case of the MGM movie in the 1930s, 40 Days of Musa Dao, that was squelched by a Turkish lobby. So by the 1960s, there was a lot of frustration and also, as I mentioned, a new generation of Armenians who are better off in different countries. And even in the remnants of historical Armenia, which was a part of the Soviet Union, there was a new generation that felt that 50 years had gone by 1965 and nothing had happened. There was no change in the situation. And practically throughout the world in that year, on the 50th anniversary, there were major demonstrations. And in Soviet Armenia, there were huge demonstrations in Yerevan that year that forced the communist government to permit the commemoration and eventual erection of monuments to its recognition. In France, in the United States, in Lebanon, and in many other parts of the Middle East. So it was nearly worldwide, in fact. Except for Turkey, of course. We can say that this was a reawakening of the Armenian people, not that they had ever forgotten or gone to sleep, but perhaps instead of reawakening, let's say a re-energizing of the Armenian people to pursue this issue in a more vigorous fashion. And indeed, they did begin to pursue the issue more, and it was from the 60s on that Armenians began to erect monuments and began to try to pursue various political avenues of redress. And this led in turn to a stronger Turkish counter-reaction, a greater denial. Now, what happened is that the Armenians tried to introduce this issue to the UN and in other places, but were not successful. And meanwhile, by the 1970s, there was a lot of turmoil in the countries in the Middle East where Armenians were living. There was the Lebanese Civil War, and there was the invasion of Cyprus by Turkey in 1974. There was instability in Iran that eventually led to the Iranian Revolution. There was all kinds of turmoil that led Armenians, who were now second generation or even third generation, to feel that perhaps they were not as welcome as they thought in these countries that they had adopted as their new homes. They felt uncomfortable because of this. And there was also an effect due to the radicalization in countries in Western Europe like France because of the student movements in 1968 and the late 60s, and the United States because of the civil rights movement, the Vietnam War, and various other ethnic movements. All these changes affected Armenians too. And they were, in a sense, inspired or moved to rediscover their own identity. If the previous generation, to a certain extent, worked towards assimilation, worked towards blending in and just, you know, making their livelihood, this new generation felt more confident to be able to express their own voice as Armenians in whatever country they lived in. But those who were in countries of turmoil, like in the Middle East, faced particular problems that radicalized them very quickly. And this led to another stage of the Armenian struggle, because like many other oppressed peoples in the world, they didn't seem to have many other choices or ways to voice their opinions. And they chose something that at the time they thought was successful for groups like the Palestinians and the Irish, and that was the way of terrorism. And this was a very brief movement for the Armenians. It started basically in 1974 or 75 and lasted until 1983. And it was set off actually a year earlier in 73 when an elderly man who was a survivor himself of the Armenian Genocide, his name was Gurkan Yanikyan, assassinated a Turkish official in San Francisco. He basically set off a movement. He wasn't the organizer of the two major groups that soon arose, but his example presumably helped give the idea to others, as well as I mentioned the examples of the radicalized movements of the Palestinians and others. And so Armenians formed two groups. The first one was called the Armenian Secret Army for the Liberation of Armenia, which was a Marxist group. It was actually supportive of the Soviet Union to a certain extent, of Soviet Armenia. and it wanted to both call the world's attention to the Armenian genocide as well as to free the territories of Western Armenia, that is the territories that the Turks had occupied and are part of Turkey today. And this group actually worked very closely with some Palestinian radical groups and soon began a series of terrorist actions against Turkish officials. There was a second group that sprang up a few years later called the Justice Commandos of the Armenian Genocide. This group was affiliated with one of the older Armenian political parties, the Armenian Revolutionary Federation, and it became, in a sense, a rival to the first group. But both groups basically were doing the same kinds of actions and got a fair amount of publicity, so that in the initial years, this actually did succeed in drawing the world's attention again to this issue of the forgotten genocide. And newspapers like the New York Times in the United States and others throughout the world spent pages on the situation. But after a few years' time, there was a counter-reaction. On the one hand, many of the countries in which these acts had taken place began to crack down on the Armenians, and also this caused some difficulties even for Armenians who had nothing to do with these terrorist actions. And secondly, the media no longer gave as much coverage. They covered events themselves, but they didn't cover the background of the genocide, which is what really was part of the real goal. And thirdly, a third factor took place, that is a splintering of these groups for a variety of reasons internally and probably through some external deliberate attempts to destabilize them. This led to instability and weakened, in particular, the Asala, the Armenian Secret Army, to such a point where there were rival factions fighting each other. And by 1983, this was probably the last year in which these groups had any significant activity. And afterwards, for all these reasons, they basically stopped existing or stopped operating. Some of the members were also captured, actually, and forced by the Turks, who captured them, to make public confessions on television in Turkey. And also during one of the Israeli invasions of Lebanon, information was given by Israeli intelligence services to Turkish intelligence services, which allowed capturing important files and kind of weakening these organizations further. And then some of the European countries like France also cracked down on the operations of these forces in their own territory. So all of these things weakened these organizations. But in a way also the Western governments tried to channel Armenians' political activities into more, let's say, legal ways. So that's when the notion of having a political resolution in Congress arose in the United States. That's when the Armenian Assembly Organization, roughly a little bit earlier than that, got started. In some sense, if you look at it as the bad cop, good cop routine, they did allow other more moderate Armenians, presumably, to have certain opportunities that perhaps they wouldn't have had otherwise. Again, I wouldn't call them a major factor in the struggle for recognition of the Armenian genocide, but certainly they did play a certain role that can't be ignored. And today, you know, this is, of course, now 20 or more years ago, and the activities of Armenians have entered into different stage. The Armenian organizations in various countries have been very active in the last 40, 50 years in trying to both persuade the governments of their host countries to acknowledge the Armenian genocide. They've been active in terms of supporting academics who do research on this topic. They've also, you know, organized a lot of grassroots activities which have kept the issue alive. So Armenians published books, they organized rallies, they held memorial services, they entered sometimes into coalitions with other groups, whether they be Jewish groups, Cambodians, Rwandans, others commemorating their own genocides, whether they be other groups on the left in various leftist coalitions of Palestinians, and in Europe all kinds of different political parties that were supportive of the Armenian Socialist and sometimes Communist Party. So it depended really on the local circumstances and the politics of the situation, but Armenians always tried within those parameters in which they faced outside of Armenia proper to struggle. Recognition is a political process more than an academic one. There was sufficient information available, you know, 90 years ago. But what is different is that on the one hand, there are a lot more state archives that have become accessible. Those are archives of the powers that had diplomats or representatives in the Ottoman Empire in that period of the genocide. And they became accessible from sometime in the 1960s. And secondly, because there's more of a general interest in genocide in general, I would say that there are more non-Armenians now who are studying these issues, and that's a difference. Obviously, there were encounters between Turkish and Armenian academics much earlier than this modern period. And when we had these kinds of events, oftentimes they were very polemical, and they didn't really serve very much to increase our knowledge of the events or to have some sort of mutual understanding of these events develop. That's changed a little bit now because there are a handful of Turkish academics who are willing to accept the events of 1915 as a genocide, or at least, even if they don't use the word genocide, they accepted the basic understanding of the events as genocide without using the actual word to avoid legal complications. And so that allows also for a new generation of younger scholars who are Turkish in background to become more curious and to explore issues connected with the Armenians. Again, sometimes cautiously approaching these things, but nonetheless, as they learn more, they become a little more confident in talking about it. And that's a positive thing, and that's opening the doors, I think, to greater understanding ultimately in Turkish civil society about the role of the Ottoman Empire and the early Turkish Republic in Armenian genocide and subsequent events. But it's a very slow process, one to be encouraged. But there's one other factor which complicates it, and that is that occasionally there are various state interests involved, including our own country's interests, that sometimes distorts this process, sometimes helps it. And that's because the United States would like to promote what it calls reconciliation in order to put aside this issue as an obstacle for American influence in Armenia and in the Caucasus. And it also wants to support Turkey's entry into the European Union. For a lot of reasons, then it wants to eliminate this issue, but it doesn't really care, as far as I can tell, exactly how it's eliminated. And so part of that process is to promote track two diplomacy as well as meetings of academics on these things. And so at times that makes it problematic how these meetings take place. But on the other hand, it does provide a good opportunity since some pressure is being brought to bear in various circles. It's an opportunity that didn't exist in the past, and as more and more Turks start to think about these issues and write about these, it'll be harder to force Turkish thought into a simple.
Massacres and genocides are as old as the human race, and many nations have been affected. Anoush Tartalyan had a conversation with Pacifica Africanist Alombe Braff to compare notes on the subject.
We're talking to Anoush Tartalyan, who is an Armenian-American, meaning that she was born, she's the first generation American, but of course her ethnic background is Armenian. And she is a person that's very, very interesting to talk to, particularly in the context of today's scandalous genocides going on all over the world. And one of the earliest genocides that people talk about is 1915. So what we want to do today is to have a chance for you to tell us about the Armenian genocide. Let people know how that impacted on the people, and the reason why it's getting such a little recognition. People don't really want to talk about it, but it keeps popping up, and now we want to find out why is that.
Well, first of all, the Turks deny that this happened. In fact, last Saturday in Times Square, they had a big demonstration saying that Armenians were liars. But there's many historical documents that...
Was a Turkish demonstration?
Yes, there was. And
What was the demonstration for?
The demonstration was... you have to realize that right now, Turkey wants to join the European Union.
Right, NATO.
But since they're known as a human rights abuser country, they try and deny that they're abusing people's human rights. But right now in Turkey, there's Article 301 that you can be imprisoned for mentioning the Armenian genocide. There are over 70 people in the courts right now. A journalist recently was threatened with years in jail for saying that the Armenian genocide happened. They are trying to deny it. And things like eyewitness accounts, they say, are forgeries. The Turks themselves after World War I, when the Ottoman Turks left and there was an interim government from 1918 to 1923, they put those Ottoman Turkish leaders on trial and found them guilty for the genocide. But the British, who had imprisoned them in Malta, exchanged them for British prisoners and let them go, and they were never really brought to trial. Mm-hmm. And it's very terrible that, you know, I've been interviewing genocide survivors right here in Flushing. There's seven in the old age homes, and you know, they pay taxes all their lives, and U.S. taxpayers have paid billions of dollars to support this dictatorship in Turkey. And, you know, when people go as tourists to Turkey, they never think that they are on occupied Armenian land, and some of the sites they're seeing are ancient Armenian monuments that have been relabeled as Turkish. And it's, besides a physical genocide, it was a cultural genocide. And myself, when I grew up, my parents never told me. I found out when I was reading in the library, and I asked my mom, why didn't you tell me? And she said, because it was too sad. And then I also realized that, I mean, if you look at me, I have light skin, and most people would think I was white. But then I'm not white. I'm a light-skinned person of color. Mm-hmm. And this is very important, because even though I have light-skinned privilege, I do not have white privilege. Mm-hmm. And there's a big difference, because white privilege means that you're in the dominant culture that benefits from...
The European culture.
Yeah, the dominant European culture that benefits from exploiting the world. And now, because Europe is afraid that they're going to be outnumbered by people of color, they're grabbing light-skinned indigenous people and claiming them as European. And this is so dangerous, because the Europeans have stolen so much. Why give them any more indigenous people? People have been miseducated. There's this movie, The First Eve, by the Discovery Channel, how the race originated in the Congo, and the first place going out of Africa was Yemen, and that the Middle East is the first transition. You know, we have African ancestors. You know, they don't really believe me. And so I have to deal with the racist education of my own people, you know, and try and make them in solidarity with other indigenous freedom struggles. For instance, Haile Selassie, during the Armenian genocide, he rescued 40 Armenians, you know, because there's a connection between the Ethiopian church and Armenian church, right? He allowed Armenians to become citizens of Ethiopia. He had Armenians as a band welcoming, you know, dignitaries. And he really understood what the atrocities that the Turks had committed. And Nelson Mandela had refused the Ataturk Peace Prize, because he also knew the human rights abuses by the Turks. But Armenian government has never honored Nelson Mandela and thanked him. They have been raised in this isolated situation where they really haven't met very many Africans or people of different cultures, because they have been isolated. And so there are stereotypes from the TV and go on. So I went back there, and there was a war going on where Azerbaijan was attacking the part of Armenia that, you know, Stalin gave part of Armenia to Azerbaijan in 1923 to destabilize the area. And then when Gorbachev announced perestroika, the Armenians wanted independence. But the Azerbaijans went to all the Armenian houses in the capital, Baku, and raped women, killed Armenians. There was a massacre. And then Armenians started a guerrilla movement to get their independence from Azerbaijan. I was part of that movement. I was 9 years in the war zone as a volunteer. And I saw that this freedom struggle is very similar to indigenous freedom struggles around the world, and that it's important for people, when they look at me, not, I feel so insulted when they say I'm white or European. And I know that the Armenian government wants to identify as European because they get more money for aid, because Armenia is really in bad shape. A third of the country have left to get jobs because of the blockade of Armenia, which you never hear about. You hear the blockade of Cuba, but you don't hear that Turkey and Azerbaijan are blockading Armenia. You know, the thing is that even though New York has over 200 nationalities, there is no organization that deals with intercultural racism. And I think this is really a big need, because I have been to places like people of color groups, and I'll say, well, I'm not white. And this woman, she said, oh, I looked up Armenian encyclopedia, and it's part of the Caucasus Mountains, and you're Caucasian, and, you know, you're a liar, get out of here. And I'm like, no, that's just European racist terminology. You know, like, they can define us, but that's not who we are.
But that's very unusual, you know, because the Europeans have been able to dominate the paradigm for everyone to adhere to. And so, therefore, it's hard to find people who are willing to say, no, I have my own background. They happen to look maybe alike, but we're not Europeans. We are people from Asia Minor. We're probably closer to Asia. And we are not denying that. We are not trying to be Europeans. Whereas in the Turks, even though most of the Turks you would see probably are darker than you, but they would love to be just generally accepted. Churchill didn't want them to be accepted as Europeans. And even now, it's one of the things that holds them back from really being swallowed up completely into both NATO and the European Union. It's a big, big fight over it. And it's not because they did the genocide. It's because the people who are Europeans look at them as Asians and Muslims. Mm-hmm. You know? So I think that that's unusual. In your viewpoint of yourself and your people in the world is very, very different. And the fact is that how many people among your people think like you, the usual way of viewing themselves as Europeans?
Well, again, it's a matter of education. The American educational system leaves out the people of color movement. In the people of color movement, there's usually five main groups: African, Asian Pacific Islanders, Latina, Caribbean, Native American, Middle Eastern, Near Eastern. And what happens is that there is no real Middle Eastern contingent because of Israel. A lot of Falasha Jews are the original darker Jews.
We call them the House of Better Israel.
Yes. They think that Russian and European Jews that are coming to Israel are white and that they're not people of color. They're just white invaders. So whenever you try to start a Middle Eastern contingent, the Israeli factor will disrupt it. And what's also really sad to me is that Israel doesn't even recognize the Armenian genocide.
Wait. Israel doesn't recognize the Armenian genocide?
No. They said it was not a genocide. It was a terrible tragedy because Israel is a strong ally of Turkey. Mm-hmm. And the geopolitics, where Americans want military bases in that region.
And because Israel having Turkey as another Muslim state, that would be neutralized. In other words, if they have a quid pro quo between the two of them, Israel feels that's better for them than to worry about the Armenian genocide.
Definitely. And they share airspace, they share water. American taxpayers have given billions of dollars to support the apartheid countries. And, for instance, the American Jewish Committee actively lobbies Congress not to recognize the Armenian genocide. In 2004, they sent letters to all the senators saying, don't recognize this. The American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, APAC, does the same thing. And of course, there are, individual Jewish scholars who speak out about the Armenian genocide. But in general, Israel as a country is not supporting the Armenian genocide at all.
Well, it's very interesting because usually Israeli foreign policy, the tendency is to identify anybody who has had a genocide because they argue that if you have undergone genocide, then you can speak on it. They did it in Rwanda when the Rwandans who had suffered genocide, by the Batutsi, so-called Tutsis, but Batutsi group was slaughtered in 94 by the Bahutu. Mm-hmm. And the idea was that for the Israelis who came to the Rwandan government later on where they went along with the United States and then turned around and then slaughtered more people, their genocide was about 1 million people in 98 days. It's one of the probably the worst genocides by number of people killed in the space of time. So they were able to get the Rwandans to go along with them in fighting against the Congo. Because what they told them is that, look, no one can tell you what to do. Once you have suffered under genocide, then you have that experience and you know that you can't afford to lose. Because if you lose, your whole people is dead. So they use it. So it's ironic that in this particular case, they would flip the script and then go back and say that we don't recognize this genocide, which actually is also interesting because the Armenian genocide in 1915 came after the Namibian genocide of 1904. Mm-hmm. And in that genocide, I always argue, I've been arguing for this for about over 30 years, that if the people were interested in human rights for all people, irrespective of race, color, and creed, and religion, they would have stopped the Germans then because the Reichsmarshal of German Southwest Africa was Heinrich Göring, who was the father of Hermann Göring, Hitler's right-hand man. So, in other words, because they allowed the genocide to take place in 1904 in Namibia, which was a practice, then they could perfect it to do what they did in Germany. And I always argue that if you really were serious, you would have stopped it right there. The whole world would have stopped the genocide in Namibia. And then perhaps what happened in 6 million Jews and other people in Europe would never have happened.
I totally agree with you. But you have to also look at the amount of Jewish influence in the press and why today is the Congo not mentioned in newspapers and on TV.
You're absolutely correct.
And I feel that, you know, if they're really interested in stopping genocides in other places, that they would deal with that.
I'm glad you recognize that, because if they really was against genocide per se, then they would have actually been talking about what was going on in the Congo, because the Congo is documented by the Western countries that since 1998, when the war jumped off to try to oust Laurent Kabila, that 4 million people have been killed, more people than all the people who were killed since World War II.
So you should
not just be talking about the Sudan. You should also be talking about the Sudan and what happened to the Rwandans who have been victimized, turn around and victimize the other people.
Yes, and you also have to look at the educational system. Here in New York, public schools, how many Jewish holidays do they get off? And yet, how many Native American holidays do they get off? Mm-hmm. The United States is allies with Turkey and won't recognize the Armenian genocide. President Bush said he would recognize it, but he lied. And then we're also getting to the problem of reparations.
Yeah.
You know, like...
Namibia is demanding reparations, and Haiti is demanding reparations, and that's why they ousted Aristide. Mm-hmm. But the thing, you're absolutely correct, but I can't really see how large a population is the Armenian people.
Right now it's around 7 million. There's actually more Armenians outside of the country of Armenia because of the blockade and the unemployment than in Armenia. But the thing is that, you know, my grandmother's family, my grandmother saw her parents shot down before her eyes and her family killed. The Turks have their demonstration that this never happened. But reparations for all indigenous peoples. There's going to be an indigenous peoples conference at the United Nations in May. Mm-hmm. You know, it's time for indigenous peoples to really get together and demand reparations for everybody. Mm-hmm. Usually when they have Middle Eastern speakers, it's just Arab speakers. A lot of people don't even know there are non-Arab Middle Easterners. You know, Armenia was the first Christian nation, and there are many other Middle Eastern peoples that aren't Arab. So you need to have diversity. You can't be divisive. We're just only having one thing and excluding other things.
Now, although you say that there's very little about it, it seems to me, I keep always hearing about 1915 when you first called me.
Yes.
You know, the idea was, I told you right away, oh, I'm very familiar with it. And it would seem that a lot of people have, the problem I'm having is that a lot of people hear it but don't pick up on it. And if you ask them about it, say, oh, yeah, I heard about it. So what? Mm-hmm. They don't make a fuss over it. They're not like you're trying to agitate people to let them know this happened and it's still, in a certain sense, happening because the people are still suffering, because people always suffer from genocide. Genocide is not something that just happens and then you forget about it. You can't forget about it. I mean, people are humiliated. Their psyches are damaged. The idea of what happened to them is something that they would have a post-traumatic syndrome based on what happened. And when they hear these stories coming from their forebears, people who went through the genocide, I mean, why should it just happen to the Europeans who happen to be Jewish, where they would remember it, but you could turn around and say that somebody else had happened to, they shouldn't. I don't understand it. It's the phenomena should be that if it happens to one person in the context of their own existence and the people who they have been harmed by, it would seem that everybody who's undergoing the same thing would have the same kind of contradiction.
Well, you have to realize that, for instance, Armenia was one of the most conquered nations on the world, being on the crossroads of so many bigger powers. And unfortunately, it's a very conservative culture. So even getting the full information of what is going on, some of the genocide survivors said, well, you're the first person I've ever talked to even tell the story. So for 40 to 60 to 90 years, these stories haven't been out there. The Armenians themselves are in political circles agitating for their freedom cause to be out there.
You see, and also when people come here, people who were not defined as white in Europe, they were just whatever that group was, and that's where they were persecuted as. It wasn't because of their color. Mm-hmm. They were the same. But when they came to this country from Europe, everybody who, because they were numerically less than the indigenous population, they had to build their own people stock, like what you said before, you know, about how they want the Europeans to realize that they call Europe a gray continent. He said, because they're not replenishing their people as much as they were before. So therefore, the idea is to build up as many people as possible and give everybody a white cover so they can be able to be utilized. People don't realize that the United States has been able to, since Perestroika and getting rid of the Soviet Union, that the Warsaw Pact countries that was faced off against NATO are now being absorbed into NATO. And the whole idea of the Project for a New American Century is the United States will be the dominant force all over the world and all over Europe, too. I mean, the Europeans will not be able to get beyond what the United States, and they don't intend to ever have another rival like the Soviet Union. And so as a result of that, what you have is that the Western powers, particularly the Bushites, they're building a white army. It would be just like the French Foreign Legion, to go everywhere they have to go. But say, like in countries like in Africa, one of the things that the anti-war movement here is missing is the whole idea of how important Africa is in this war that nobody's talking about. I mean, they talk about it, but it doesn't mean anything because they have come to the point where they accept that, oh, you know, Africans are always going to be hungry, they're always starving, it's their own fault. They don't talk about imperialism, how it plays a role in actually destroying people and actually pauperizing people. You know, they don't understand that Africa is the richest continent in the world. And the reason why there's not the fundamental contradiction there is that the Africans don't have their wealth. They don't have any control of their wealth. So what I'm arguing is that the same thing you were saying about how they want to get more white people in Europe is the same thing they're really doing now as they start to bring people into the European Union and they start to bring up people into the NATO. And so therefore, the Soviet Union, Azerbaijan, and all the other Stan countries, all of them have been actually minimized to the point where they don't even understand how they're being misused. And in Africa, because of the so-called war on terror, the United States has been able to get the FBI, the all military intelligence all over the continent to say, look, you're very vulnerable to Al-Qaeda, so therefore we're going to put up a base here. So you have bases being strung all across Africa, even at the same time as they talk about building an African Union.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think it's very important for people to recognize their African ancestry and stand up to be light-skinned people of color. This intercultural racism is a very serious thing. You have to have dialogue with people. You have to, like, try and think, what is that difference between being light and a light-skinned person of color? You know, I would be happy to come and give talks to any educational place that wants me. I also have videos of the war zone in Armenia when I was there. You know, I interviewed a lot of the hostages and torture victims. And Middle Eastern things should be included in people of color studies. And I also have a lot of information on Armenian women because a lot of times Middle Eastern cultures, women have a certain position, but I think that there needs to be some way to have that representation and without the anger and the hatred about light skin taking over. And so I'm trying to do my part dealing with the racism in my own community and introducing them to knowledge about Africa. But I can't do it alone. I need the community's help.
Right. So you really have a difficult time because you have to try to get the Armenian community to understand. You have to get them up to speed.
Do you know that April 24th is International Genocide Commemoration Day because on that day the Turks killed 300 intellectuals. And so when we had our demonstration here, I said to the committee, please invite a Native American speaker to do the opening blessings because we're on Native American land. They've also been through a genocide. You know, it was a longer one, but it's the same thing. And to this day, they have never invited that Native American speaker, and it hurts me. It's painful to deal with racism in every direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, these things, these contradictions happen because, first of all, when you talk about the African community has been ripped off. So many things have happened to it, has undergone so many changes, has seen so many contradictions, seen people promising, making so many promises, and then turning around. And then one of the worst things that African people feel is that the denial of self-determination. That white people, in general, believe that they can come and lead anybody, you know, because they know it all. Whereas black people saying, look, we tried everything else. And we also know what we had before we came in contact with Europeans. So therefore, what we want to do is see, let's try this. Now, you had other people always messing in Africans' business for their own ulterior motives. So therefore, people very skeptical, although right now I don't think it's as sharp as it was before, particularly when the Renaissance came and we helped to initiate in the early 60s about black pride and African awareness. Mm-hmm. But the point is that when you say that the United Nations is going to have an indigenous conference, of people from all, and that you also invited. I think therein lies the rub. We're the ones going to dictate, you know, who we are. Everybody has to tell who you are. You have to tell who your story. That's why I'm willing to listen to it, because I've always believed, really, that the Armenians got a bad deal. Mm-hmm. But what you have actually brought to the table shows how bad it really was.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the number one problem of light-skinned people of color in America is resisting assimilation. Mm-hmm. And I would like to tell you about this wonderful magazine called Cultural Survival. And they have a website, and they have stories of indigenous peoples around mm-hmm. the world, mm-hmm. you know. And when I was in Kenya, they had a United Nations conference on the status of women in 85, and the Turkish representatives had the police take me out because they said that I was telling lies about the genocide. And this Kenyan man who had worked with an Armenian took me to these villages where I was, you know, talking with them, and we had solidarity. And, you know, I'm very lucky that I had an opportunity to go to the motherland. I think nowadays a lot of people don't have that opportunity, but I think the indigenous people of the world, you know, we have had our land taken away. We have been raped and defiled and degraded in every way. And now it's time for us to realize that we have the power of the rocks inside the earth, that power. And we are that strength, and we will survive.
Well, Anoush Tertullian, I'd like to thank you for sharing this time with us. And we, of course, try to get the word out to as many people about the struggle that people are having in Armenia still today. And that the idea, if people are going to really have a move towards social justice, they have to remember that they can't forget things that are taking a kind of a toll on people, like a genocide. And therefore, I guess in a country that was based on genocide, this country was founded on genocide. The population here from, say, Alaska all the way to the tip of Chile at one time in this hemisphere was 100% indigenous.
That's right.
And what are they now? And see, and because of that, we can't never forget that, too. That's the biggest story. But it shows you what the smaller stories, when you link them all together, genocide is something that should never be conceived and never executed.
Yes, and just remember, everyone that looks white may not be white.
The Armenian Assembly is lobbying members of Congress to pass legislation recognizing the Armenian Genocide. Their website is www.aaainc.org. The Armenian National Committee monitors and opposes defamation of Armenians regarding the denial of the genocide. They have also worked with Congress and have joined coalitions to help Darfur. Their website is www.anca.org. The Zorian Institute has archived interviews with hundreds of genocide survivors, and books relating to their stories can be found at the St. Vartan Cathedral and Armenian Prelacy bookstores in New York City. Since 1988, Armenians in the eastern province of Nagorno-Karabakh have been fighting for self-determination and declared their independence from Azerbaijan in 1991. Despite a ceasefire, Armenians still die every year from landmines and sniper fire. From Yerevan, the capital of present-day Armenia, one can see the snow-capped peaks of Mount Ararat, the sacred symbol of ancient Armenia, which today is under Turkish control.